Hello, I'm Ross Camage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the ups and downs, highs and lows of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And today I have a very special guest, Sonia Okuyama Sasaki. And Sonia, would you like to introduce yourself to the audience in any way you see fit?
Sure. Thank you, Ross. My name is Sonia Okuyama Sasaki. I am a medical oncologist. I've been an oncologist for about 12 years, and I am currently the division chief in the place where I work, which is Denver Health.
Let's explain what Denver Health is.
Denver Health is the safety net institution health system in Denver County. So we are a pretty big place. It consists of, you know, of course, the main hospital, all the subspecialty clinics, but it also has about 10 primary care locations, which are all federally qualified health centers. We hold a level one trauma center, poison control, the 911 system. It's a Wow. pretty neat place to be at.
And then imagine that I don't know what a safety net hospital is. Can you try and explain that for someone who's perhaps not familiar with the U.S. or this specific system?
Right. Well, the healthcare system here in the U.S. is very complex. There are for-profit, nonprofit type of institutions. We are nonprofit, so we are not driven by making money. Our mission is to take care of everybody in the county of Denver, regardless of their ability to pay. So we have a large population of patients who are in government-subsidized insurance products, such as Medicaid, or, you know, we have a big proportion of uninsured patients as well. And we take pride in taking excellent care of all of these patients, regardless of what kind of money they bring in.
Somebody has to pay the bills. So where's the money coming from?
That's a bigger question. Right now, we are having issues. Really, the people who have private insurance tend to be subsidizing the care for everybody else. The regular health insurance does. I know the city gives Denver Health a very limited amount of money. That is a small fraction of the uncompensated care that we provide. But other than that, we are a very lean, efficient system, but not without challenges for sure.
What proportion of your patients either doesn't have English as a first language, is homeless, has psychiatric issues? I mean, it's a mixed bag.
I think that's where my expertise comes in, right? You are an expert in lung cancer. I'm an expert in underserved patient population, where cancer is many times the least of their problems. I would say a good third of my patients may not have insurance. It's not uncommon for me to find patients who, you know, have to worry about where they're going to eat next or sleep next. I also not infrequently will see patients who don't know how to read and write. They can hide that quite well. It's always very humbling to identify those barriers to their care and be able to help them. I would say a good third, for example, may have a combination of these challenges.
Actually, that's a really interesting question. I don't think I've ever asked a patient if they can read and write. I mean, how do you even put that in the conversation?
We always ask them, how do they learn best? And sometimes you start digging things. Or, for example, you know, when you are wanting them to participate in a clinical trial, and then you go through the informed consent or just the chemotherapy informed consent, then you start to realize that they're struggling to sign or asking for other people to do it for them. And those are the clues of something else going on.
And what proportion of your patients do you think have Spanish as their primary language?
My particular practice, just because I am a native Spanish speaker, would be at least half of my patients are Spanish speakers. For our practice, we're probably in the 30, 40%.
You got a Japanese name and you just said you're a native Spanish speaker. Okay, so join the dots for people going, huh? These things don't go together.
That is right. My grandparents were born in Japan and they immigrated to Peru, so in South America, in the early 1900s. So I'm a third generation Japanese immigrant to Peru. So I was born and raised and did all my medical school in Peru. I consider myself, so my race is Japanese, or Asian, but my ethnicity is Latina. So I'm a Latina girl. I like the food from Peru, the music that I listen to, and the music that I dance to is definitely, I'm 100% Latina.
I heard through a little bird that you're actually quite the salsa dancer.
I am.
I'm a Northern European, and I don't think our pelvises are articulated that way. I think you have to be, you know, clearly the Japanese pelvis is articulated the same way as the South American pelvis.
I don't know. I think it's part of the upbringing. It's funny, when I have met folks from Japan, they say that they can tell I'm not Japanese from far away just because I speak with my hands quite a bit. So that's the Latina in me. That's right.
All right. So you're going through Peru, and when do you go, okay, my future lies in a different country?
I was lucky to have a fantastic schooling. I went to an all-girls British high school where it was an immersion school. So my teachers were all British from kindergarten. So I was very much exposed to a very international community very early on. So it wasn't scary or daunting to consider, you know, leaving the country. I did medical school. I graduated first in my class. And despite that achievement, I was not able to find a job in medicine right after medical school. In Peru, internship is part of medical school. So you graduate with a license to practice as a general practitioner. And I just couldn't find a job because I didn't have the right connections. Peru is a place where many times that's what you need to get into a job. And so it really was out of necessity for me. You know, I took my steps, all those exams, and did my interviews, and that's how I ended up here in the U.S. I mean, it was a long, hard journey, as any foreign medical graduate will tell you, but I was very lucky and successful to be able to be where I am today after that struggle.
How long were you looking for a job after medical school?
A couple years. I mean, I would take certain shifts here and there, but it was a good couple of years that I was preparing to come here.
Did you ever think, oh my goodness, this isn't going to be the career for me? I mean,
no.
Really?
No, not at all. I actually first started in biology. So in Peru, you go from high school directly into medical school. And I did not go that route. I first went to biology school. And then halfway through, when I started doing lab work, I realized this is not what I want. I want people. I want something more involved with the direct patients. And that's when I switched to medicine.
And then I think your first residence in the U.S. was UT Southwestern in Dallas.
That's right, which is a fantastic training program. They really like my medical school. And so they typically will take one person from my medical school every year. So there was already that connection. And so that's how I ended up there.
And then when did you go, okay, oncology, that's the thing for me.
That was probably during medical school. I think it was the only thing that I would be able to read and learn and enjoy learning without falling asleep in the middle of it. I think, you know, the cardiology books would be in with some type of post-nap drool over them, but not oncology. I always enjoyed that.
When you're in your high school, you're immersed in English, so you were speaking English, but then medical school was in Spanish?
That's correct, yes.
Wow, you just have to turn different sides of your brain on and off all the time.
That's right. And then when I started intern year at UT Southwestern in Parkland Hospital, I always sound Parkland proud, to learn medicine in English was yet another big challenge. So that was also quite difficult, but doable. Thankfully, my first rotation was in the emergency room. So you just had to pick up the number of patients you could handle. And for me, it was probably two or three patients in a 12-hour shift, just because I was learning the system.
Wow. You pick up as many patients as you can handle. So that sounds like this. So there's a big team there. I mean, Parklands is famous for sort of being a bit of a war zone. Can I say that without offending
it
anyone?
It totally is. It is a fun place, lots of camaraderie, crazy cases, but it was a really perfect fit for me. I really thrived there.
And then did you think about staying in Texas? I mean, what was going on in your life when you moved to Colorado for your oncology fellowship?
When I was in Texas, I was single. I was living for the first time in my life by myself with an income. So that was fun.
It's like you'd grown up. Like, look at me.
That's right. Yeah. I was calling my mom, you know, sometimes and telling her, well, tonight I'm going to go this place and I'll be back by this hour. And my mom, you know, in a whole different country, is like, well, you know, I don't need to know any of these things. But just I was not used to not being accountable for my whereabouts. Second year of residency, I already was in a very committed relationship with somebody, also a physician, internal medicine. He's pulmonary critical care. So back then, you know, what we did was couples match. And that is how we ended up in Colorado. He came to the pulmonary program here, is fantastic, and I came as a plus one.
Yeah, the trailing spouse. I've had another guest on here who, you know, has recognized the unattractive nature of that title. But sometimes we get the best people. Sometimes the trailing spouse is much better than the person that they're trailing.
I think so, but I'm biased.
Okay, of course. In the value of totally blending as many different cultures as possible, and my understanding, your husband is neither Japanese nor Hispanic.
His dad is Lebanese and his mom is Hungarian. So we are quite a bit of a melting pot in this family.
I'm just imagining, like, if the World Cup is on, it's like, who on earth do you cheer for? It's like, well, you're obviously going to cheer for Peru, but it's the best team.
If they make it to the World Cup, which has happened, I think, once in my whole lifetime.
So my family's from Scotland, and it's like, I think they've been there about once, too.
But then it's always a big deal, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then they totally fail. You know, they get starstruck.
But mathematically, they're so close.
So you end up in Colorado and you're going through your oncology training. This is the thing that's always amazed me, is like, you are the perfect person to end up in this Denver Health job, because you're a native Spanish speaker. You know, you've been through the bit where, you know, you sometimes don't know where the next job or the next penny is coming from. And then it was like this job was made for you. When did you realize? I mean, presumably there was someone in the job before you.
It was one of our wonderful colleagues who told me that, you know, when I was going through my training here, and she told me, Sonia, I really think this job is perfect for you. Dr. Tienelt, I will always credit her for that. She's at the VA right now, but she was kind of transitioning her careers. And so this opportunity opened up, and she very specifically said, Sonia, this is for you. And she was absolutely right. And I'm so thankful to her for that.
Did you go straight into fellowship to having that fancy director title?
No. No, I was an attending for 8 years.
You've been at Denver Health for 8 years? Wow.
No, I've been at Denver Health for 12 years. That's how long you and I know each other. Because you were probably one of my very first attendings in fellowship.
Isn't that weird? The time has gone so quickly. So when did you become the division head?
About 4 years ago.
I mean, what have those 12 years been like? Have you seen Denver Health change? It's not like the societal problems go away or the financial problems go away. Are they getting better? Are they getting worse?
I think our team is definitely in a much better spot. So when I took over as division chief, it was very challenging times. There was staff turnover. You know, this is not an easy place to practice. And sure enough, it's not for everybody. So back then, due to staff turnover, it was pretty much Mike, who's my colleague, and myself, just the two of us hustling and having to rebuild from scratch. But it was really my opportunity to build the team that I thought we needed to have. And so, you know, slowly and surely, we held off to make sure that we waited for the right people to hire. And now we are a 5-physician team. We have a oncology pharmacy specialist. We have a solid infusion center, a solid clinic. All of that I've had the pleasure to build from literally the ashes, even our reputation. For when I first started as division chief, I remember being told that, oh gosh, the oncology unit, they're troublemakers, they're the black sheep of the Department of Medicine. You guys can't seem to hire or retain people. You know, our metrics were all terrible. And all of that, you know, with a lot of work, we've been able to turn around in 180 degrees. And that is something that I particularly enjoy doing. My administrative role is a lot of fun, and I know I've been able to do it well. It's probably one of my proudest achievements.
What was the secret? I mean, what allowed you to attract people in and to keep them there? What was your vision of what you wanted it to be and what you've achieved? That was about 4 different questions at the same time.
I think, first of all, I knew this place in and out. I knew, you know, having been here 8 years prior as a staff oncologist, I knew what were the strengths, what were our weaknesses. I knew the limitations. And then I really enjoy the building of teams. I really enjoy the whole operations component of it, you know, figuring out how the workflow happens, how to make it better. I enjoy my Excel spreadsheets with the metrics. So when people talk about productivity and RVUs and things like that, I like to understand what all goes into that data set. I always say, know the game, know the rules, play the game. So know the rules and play the games. I don't think that we necessarily are working harder. I think that by understanding those metrics and making them work and really show the work that we are doing, all those numbers now just showcase the good work that we've always were doing.
So it's more showing to an outside people the value that was already there?
Yes, yes. I think, you know, there was a lot of organization to make that happen, but I don't think that, you know, my practice significantly changed. I always, you know, did the best that I could for our patients. It just wasn't showing in some of those numbers. And to get it to show to those numbers was to understand how those were measured and making sure that the right things hit in those measurement data points so that then you could see things like access, right? Like we always knew that we would get in a new cancer patient in within 2 weeks, yet our access metric looked like it was a month or more out. And so what was going on, it was the benign hematology patients that was mixing up the picture. So, okay, if that's the case, let's split it up and completely creating two different metrics, the hematology one that is totally okay to see in a month versus the cancer ones that we do see within a couple of weeks. And sure enough, with that, our whole numbers just look significantly better. And so, you know, little things like that, needing to understand what really is behind those numbers and just trying to showcase what we are doing and tell our story in a language that is understandable by our administration.
One of the things that we know about oncology is the treatments, whether they're surgery, radiation, or drugs, are super expensive. And you're in this incredibly resource-constrained environment. How do you do that? How do you say, look, standard of care treatment costs a gazillion dollars and we have 10 bucks?
We've been able to leverage the patient assistance programs pretty strongly. So we work directly with the pharmaceutical companies to get their drugs for free. Actually, for me, it is easier to take care of a patient with Medicaid or without insurance because I always get my drug. We have people whose sole job is to get me the drug. Different story, someone who has private insurance, I have to fight and get peer-to-peer and authorizations and that type of stuff. It's actually more work. So we have been able to do that, but that's drugs. Things that remain uncompensated, for example, are the scans, the PET scans, the blood work, and the physician time, and that unfortunately goes uncompensated. But my institution is very generous. If we have it here available, we will make it available for our patients.
What about just getting the patients in? Do they have transport to get them in and on time, or is that a challenge too?
It is definitely a challenge. I actually had a meeting earlier today just for that. I think transportation is still our number one barrier to get people in where at the right time, at the right place. There's too many appointments that someone needs to go to. And if a patient relies on the bus, for example, there's a high likelihood that they're going to be late and things like that. No, we haven't figured that one out yet.
I mean, I have for the patients I see who are Medicaid, the other one we had the other day, we couldn't get a hold of them because they didn't have a cell phone. They had a landline and they weren't standing by the phone. And it's just realizing the practicalities, you know, are very different for different people.
Yes. And that's why our team has to do a lot of babysitting, a lot of hand holding, and we try to do as much as possible while the patient is still there. Before they leave, we need to make sure that all as many appointments are scheduled precisely to avoid that issue of not being able to reach them.
Do you have issues with undocumented patients being afraid to sort of appear on the record and have medical records and things like that?
There is some of that, but I think that they know that we are in their corner medically, personally, and that they know that we are not going to do anything. I mean, we really can't do anything about it. We don't rat anybody out. I don't even know how to do that. So,
well, that's good. I mean, they have to trust you. That sounds like they should appropriately trust you.
Yeah, no, I think they know that we are there for them.
Let me ask a question about mental health, which I think is, you know, one of the more underserved things in the whole of the country. But I mean, I imagine that's even more enriched in your population there. How do you address that?
We are lucky now to have integrated behavioral health as a practice model throughout Denver Health. So we have psychologists who are embedded in our clinic so that they are able to meet the patient right away and connect them to the right resources. And that is something that Denver Health as an institution has really done a fantastic job at supporting. That being said, I did not have that in the beginning. And I'm just trying to think, you know, my journey actually with research has always been trying to plug those operational holes that I, you know, didn't have in the past. So, for example, when I first started as an attending, I didn't have a psychologist right there and then. So then I would seek research projects where I would be able to bring through those projects, I would be able to bring behavioral health support into the clinic. So that was my first, you know, dabbling into these types of projects, which was a lot of fun. Then afterwards, behavioral health became integrated into the clinic, and so I didn't need those projects anymore to compensate for that lack. So then the next step was palliative care. Back then, I did not have palliative care in the clinic, or actually, I think the whole institution didn't have palliative care, so I started partnering with palliative care researchers and creating interventions for my patients so that we could would be able to provide that support. Those collaborations were also fun. They did provide, you know, that extra layer of support. And then, you know, several years later, because of the success of these programs, you know, palliative care, I now have them in the clinic next to me. So my last iteration of research collaboration projects to supplement my operational deficiencies has been in everything related to hereditary cancer, genetic testing, and all that type of stuff. So it is interesting how a need or a deficiency in my day-to-day has provided me with opportunities through research and collaborations to compensate for those and make it work.
You know, the funny thing is, I think with your drive, you've actually got some stuff that we don't have. We don't have integrated behavioral care. So I think you have really taken this and sort of, as you said, elevated it to an enviable level where the people with the least are actually getting more than some of the people with, you know, the most resource. That's pretty amazing to me. One of the things we talked about the other day is the whole issue of Medicaid and where cancer is viewed in Medicaid. Is it a right? Is it a privilege? Can you just expand a little bit on that?
Coming from a different country, a different healthcare system, I'm always surprised at how the health care system here in the U.S. is so disjointed. I think everybody expects health care to be a right, yet the way that the system is built is not so. Health care really in this country is a privilege, yet mm-hmm. people expect to receive it as a right. And so what happens is if you don't have insurance or if you don't have private insurance, it can be more challenging to find doctors and health systems to provide care for you. That pool is just very narrow. The problem is that there's certain diagnoses, especially cancer, that you cannot just ignore. Someone will eventually be taking care of this. If you are not getting cancer care right away, you will end up in an emergency room. And then the healthcare expenditure for that problem at that time is going to be much, much higher than if you had taken care of it way beforehand. Other diagnoses are the same. For example, people who need dialysis. You cannot just ignore the fact that you have dialysis. Yeah. If you don't get it, you end up in the ER. At least in Colorado, I'm not an expert with the rest of the country. If you don't have insurance but show up in the emergency room, you are covered by emergency Medicaid. And Medicaid is the government program for people who do not have insurance or are under-resourced. So this is actually regardless of whether you are a U.S. citizen or not. But if you show up in the ER, that episode should be covered by emergency Medicaid.
But so, that's it. It's that episode. It's like, yeah, the emergency is covered. But then right. dot, dot, dot.
Correct. So anything else as an outpatient, it's still up in the air, it's still uncompensated, or no one will take care of you. So here at Denver Health, we had a hospitalist who did fantastic work with emergency dialysis patients. So she's actually now faculty now at the university. She did a lot of very interesting research about the experience of patients with emergency dialysis who would get care in the emergency room, yet not in a regular dialysis unit. And with very close collaboration with the state legislature, we were able to get dialysis covered as an outpatient, not just in the ER, but also as an outpatient via emergency Medicaid. And so that, you know, completely turned on my little light bulb. And so I talked to her. It's like, okay, so what can we do? Can I just follow your same footsteps and talk to the same people? And that's exactly what we've been doing. We completed the same type of qualitative research about the experience of being a cancer patient and all that coverage, presenting all that data to the state legislature. And so I think we're pretty close to making cancer an emergency Medicaid eligible condition, such that you can get care not just in the emergency room, but also in the outpatient world. Now, this is also actually already in place in several other states. For example, Washington State is one. In Minnesota, they have that as well. So it's not unheard of. So we're very excited about that. And then that way, I may be able to get reimbursed for the work that we're doing with these patients in the outpatient world.
That would be incredible. Was it the argument that you actually had to make an economic case that when they turn up in the emergency room, that costs more to the whole system than if you actually managed it proactively? Or was it an emotional case?
It was both. Definitely both of them. It's a game changer in my mind, right? Even though we don't have universal health care, clearly the population wants and expects that up to a certain point, you know, at least for the more basic emergency, you know, needs. So I think we're going to get there state by state, diagnosis by diagnosis.
So there are analogies with how when I first got here, which is, you know, maybe about 17 years ago, so maybe 5 years before you got here. When I first got here, I was very used to palliative care, which was established and very strongly infiltrated in the UK. And, you know, I got my first patient in horrible pain and I went, so who's the palliative care team? And they went, the what? And we had to go through this bit of actually making an economic case and initially started with inpatients. And it was based on the fact that, you know, rather bluntly, if the palliative care team was involved, people stopped spending money on expensive but completely futile measures. You know, mine was an emotional argument or a kind of moral argument, but you had to make that economic case first. And then gradually over time, as people got used to the palliative care team, and I guess probably got to know the practitioners, the administrators were then much more receptive to bringing this and actually integrating into the outpatient. And as one of my colleagues told me the other day, it's like, well, nobody really looks at our finances now. And it's like, yes.
I'm sure they do.
I'm sure somebody looks at them, but maybe they get a pass or something like that. You know, they fly under the radar in terms of total expenditure.
Palliative care is challenging because the value that they bring to the table is not easily measurable. But they make the journey for the patient and for us who are taking care of these patients so much better to be able to rely on experts who know how to best, you know, manage the suffering. Because the pain is not only a physical pain, there's all sorts of pain involved. And that multidisciplinary team is so valuable. And that I don't think anybody has been able to figure out how to measure.
When I first came here from Britain and the whole idea that patients had to pay to see me, I couldn't quite process because it was like it's free at the point of delivery ever since the 1940s. And the way as a physician, this is how I lived with it, was that the patients who were coming to see me still had a need. It wasn't like I was seeing the worried well just because they could pay for it. So I was able to sleep at night by saying, well, okay, my clinic's still full and these people still have a need. There are clearly people who can't get into my clinic, but my clinic's full anyway. So, you know, they have to go somewhere else. But you've really kind of gone the other way. It's like, you know, send me your huddled masses and I will see them, you know, no matter what. And that's amazing.
It hasn't come without challenges, but that's pretty much what we've done. That's right.
So as one foreign medical graduate to another, I do think immigrants work harder, and because we don't take it for granted, especially for certain, you know, political regimes, is always the worry they're going to take it away from you too.
Hamilton said that, right? The musical Hamilton, immigrants, we get the job done.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Although they sang it somewhat better than I probably would have done. So do you remember when you became a citizen?
2020, because it was in the middle of a pandemic.
I mean, I became one in 2017, and it was strangely emotionally moving for me. I thought I was just going to turn up and get the certificate, and that was fine, and I teared up.
Yes, I was also surprised by my response as well, because it really was emotional, and I remember being surprised at it. I wonder why. I've been here for so long at this point. My family is here. You know, my kids were born here. I cannot imagine leaving. But then to be able to vote, goodness, that was exciting.
I think mine was even more smushy than that. Mine was just like, well, these people want me. They weren't forced to have me because I was born here. They actually made a choice. And it felt, you know, I don't know, it felt welcoming. I mean, I had a fabulous person who did the kind of introductory speech. They really did make us feel like, you know, we were joining a family. It was awesome.
Yeah, it was COVID. So I think after my interview, you know, where they do all these testing questions, they just had me stand up right there and then. So I missed out on the speech, but it was still emotional.
I still have the little Stars and Stripes flag that they give to you on the day.
It
was kind of cool. So my understanding is that your husband threw a party for you after you became a citizen.
He did. He grilled up some hot dogs, and then we had apple pie and vanilla ice cream. And so a very, and it had like red, white, and blue streamers all over the house. So that was fun. That was a nice surprise.
Yeah, I think my wife did something similar and got me a t-shirt that had like a half of a Union Jack and half of a Stars and Stripes on it. And I wore it proudly until I washed it with something pink, and then it went, blech. You said your kids were born here. How old are your kids?
I have a 10-year-old daughter and an 8-year-old son.
What do they identify as in terms of race and ethnicity?
Very American. They actually look Hispanic, is what I always think. But yeah, they consider themselves run-of-the-mill, bread-and-butter American.
Can they speak Spanish?
They understand a little bit, but unfortunately they do not speak it, because I don't speak Spanish to my husband. So they know I speak English, and they won't let me speak too much Spanish. They complain. They'll regret it, and I probably am too lazy to push it.
It's not like you have no other demands on your time. I mean, you took on this kind of multi-headed monster, and you started to tame it, and then you've also got to, you know, look after a young family too. So there's only so many hours in the day. I hope they'll remember that when they look back.
They're very proud of the work that I do. I actually bring them here to work not infrequently. When I'm on call on the weekends, they have space in my office. They have their little crayons and activity books, and they come with their iPads, and they come and stick around. They have come sometimes when they are sick and I can't send them to school, and I have a little cot here, and they hang out here. I used to have the clinic right next to this office. Now we have moved, but before, they would be here and I would be able to look after them. They know all of my team members. Again, the team that I have built here has been very understanding to the fact that I have a life outside of medicine. And that is also the way that I recruit. I think that the people that work here, all of us, all the faculty here, know that that's an important part for us as people, that we work hard, but we also are very present parents, very involved in our communities and a lot of things that we do.
That's a great segue to thinking about the future. So, I mean, given all that you have achieved, which is quite incredible, it's not like you have now fixed the whole of society. So let's say over the next 5 years, what do you want, you know, Sonia Okuyama's work life and private life to be doing?
Hopefully in 5 years, the kids are going to be doing well in high school and I will have a good relationship with them. That's definitely an objective. At work, I still see myself here. I love what I do. I always say I would do it for free, but I'm very glad I get paid. I would like to pursue Probably additional training. I keep thinking about getting an MBA to get those little letters to support the work that I do and enjoy doing. In 5 years is when one of my big grants, the current R01 that I have, will be ending, which is a genetics one. So at that time point, the whole genetics program at Denver Health should be operational instead of grant funded. That is a goal that I have. I'm hoping that many of the team members that I currently have, whether physicians or nurses or medical assistants, are also up and on their next step in their career. So I can't do this forever. I think someone else needs to come with their fresh ideas and become division chief. And I think I have great candidates coming behind me to do that. Or, for example, my medical assistant that I'm grooming to become the manager of that genetics program. I do have very concrete plans in 5 years. 10 years, that might be a little bit tougher, but I think for five, I have it down.
Well, nobody knows what we're going to be doing in 10 years' time. Let's end on what was your catchphrase? Know the game, know the rules, play the game.
No, it's know the rules, play the game.
I love it. Sonia, thanks so much.